Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, a state-appointed review team finds the small city of Hamtramck is once again in a state of financial emergency. Will the city succumb to state control again? And nearby Detroit, one prominent observer has growing doubts about what's going on with the city's emergency manager. We'll find out why. But first, Michigan's business and political leaders have gathered today on Mackinac Island. This is the opening day of the Detroit Regional Chamber's big annual policy conference, which runs through Friday. There will be plenty of speeches and panel discussions about the economy, education, health care, and a wide range of other policy issues. And just as importantly, the conference is a chance for politicians, a chance for them to network, to schmooze, and to drum up support and donations. Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are on Mackinac right now tracking all of this, and they join us now. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Cindy.
Well, first off, Zoe, give us a little more detail about what's going on at this conference. We can hear it happening all around you.
I know. Rick and I are here in the midst of the conference. We're in the media room right now. We are all sort of huddled together. I shouldn't say we are all huddled together. There is a lot of room, a lot of media here at this conference. You know, thousands attend, the governor, lawmakers, congressmen and women, the business community, CEOs, entrepreneurs, lobbyists. And
I don't know if you can hear it, but actually that's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who's actually delivering a speech in the background.
He is in the background.
Okay.
And as I was saying, you know, the policy is full to the brim this year of folks. A joke was made earlier that, you know, the island might actually sink from all the weight of everyone here. But, I mean, you know, it is interesting dynamic. We're all on this island, people really well-dressed. Meanwhile, you know, this island, you can't have cars on it.
Right.
So people are walking to and from the beautiful Grand Hotel. There's horses and horse manure around that we're all trying to, you know, stay away from. So it's an interesting
one of the great
dynamic.
Things that comes out of this is shin splints.
Shin splints and dodging manure, right?
Exactly.
What do you see as the main agenda items this year?
You know what? It's always kind of a moving target, but obviously since this is a politics and business conference, a lot of it is about jobs. And like I said, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who's widely talked about as a possible Republican presidential aspirant, is just wrapping up. And he talked a lot about entrepreneurialism and education, that he urged the state of Michigan to stick with the Common Core education standards. And that comes as literally today, the legislature sent the governor, Governor Rick Snyder, an education budget that actually freezes funding for implementing those education standards. So that's kind of a big deal. And what that means is that Governor Snyder now has to go back to the drawing board and try to convince the legislature to release that funding to make that happening. And we should also point out that Governor Bush, who is considered to be something of a governor in the same model as Rick Snyder, mm-hmm. took a lot of time to sort of, you know, give one tough nerd a shout out about the job that he's done. And all of this is happening as the person we are now presuming is going to be the governor's Democratic adversary, Mark Schauer, is hanging out in the wings.
Also, there's a big focus on education, isn't there, Zoe?
There is. We will hear from Michelle Rhee, CEO of Students First. She's also the former chancellor of the D.C. public schools, a somewhat controversial figure. She'll be speaking about education reform. We're also going to hear from Carlos Gutierrez, the former U.S. Secretary of Commerce. So, you know, what they do is they have big names here in Michigan, but they also go out into the country, business leaders, politicians that they think are going to give some good speeches and have some interesting things to say. So we'll hear from a wide range of, mm-hmm. of people.
And the business leaders who are here that for a long time, this is a group that's endorsed more money for early childhood education. And even though they didn't get what they want with the Common Core standards, that there is a lot more money for early childhood. Governor Snyder talked about it in his introductory remarks. And there's this sense that we're making a lot of progress in ensuring that every child will at least have access to a quality preschool experience. So there's talk about that. There's a lot of talk about the future of charter schools. buildings and school choice in Michigan, online education, which is a big push of the governor's, and in recent weeks it's been somewhat controversial as members of his administration were involved in an effort to sort of shake up the education system, make it less expensive by offering more technology in education. Those are all things that are being talked about up here.
And this group that Rick is talking about, it's been dubbed Skunk Works.
Right.
And on the ferry ride up here, Rick and I were actually on the ferry ride with Governor Snyder. He had, I think two cell phones and an iPad in front of him. So he was obviously working on the ferry. But then when you get off the ferry, thinking of Skunk Works.
Right. There's a group called Progress Michigan. It's a liberal progressive group that, as you would expect, is very, very critical of Governor Snyder. So people, as they were walking off the boat, were met with a person in sort of a giant bobblehead Rick Snyder costume and a skunk. And
a person little, dressed up as a skunk, a skunk mascot.
Yep,
very
and
good.
And a Pepe Le Pew
air freshener
for the cars that are not allowed on Mackinac Island.
How subtle. Now, we know, guys, this conference is put together by the Detroit Regional Chamber, and that's, of course, a pro-business group. But let's get in more about the politics that'll be happening up here.
Absolutely, Cindy. I mean, this is the time that lawmakers can meet up and talk to influential leaders, begin to campaign, whether or not they really want to admit that that's what they're doing, right? They don't want to actually say we're coming up here to campaign, but this is the time that they're sitting down with folks that they're trying to get their support from, and let's be honest, they're financial donations from. So this is a time to do some...
That there's a wide array of people here representing a large number of interests, foundations, Republicans, Democrats, but there's one thing that they have in common. And that's money.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And there are politicians up here who are hoping to get access to it. As a matter of fact, Mark Schauer just filed his campaign statement, creating a campaign committee, because literally if you're a politician running for office, you're not allowed to accept a check if you don't have someplace to put it.
Ah,
I don't think it's any accident that that campaign committee was formed the day before the Democratic hopeful is arriving here on the island.
And then, Cindy, also there's, you know, the gubernatorial race. There's also the U.S. Senate race. Cindy, you talked with Bobby Shostak, of course, on yesterday's show, chairman of the Republican Party. You talked a little bit with him about who would be running as the Republican candidate in the Senate seat. We do have some news on that today.
Non-news.
We thought there was a chance that Congressman Mike Rogers, a Republican, it represents the 8th District of Michigan. We thought that there was some chance that he would declare his candidacy on the island. We spoke with his office today that said don't expect as much.
Right. So a lot of candidates are saying that June 1st is sort of the informal cutoff to get in or get out, because in a state like Michigan, which has long, cold winters, when you've got an open seat like this, it really takes two summers of campaigning if you're really going to mount a serious race. And so there are some people who are thinking that maybe the U.S. Senate race, right now we've got the Democrat Gary Peters, but maybe the U.S. Senate race would launch on this island at this conference where politics is such a prevailing theme.
But it seems not that one at this point, unless they're throwing you a curveball.
Right, and my guess is that we'll also maybe see some other candidates jump in, maybe even in the next week, kind of needling along, going, hey, you know, Congressman Rogers.
We'll hear from Terry Lynn Land, by the former Secretary of State, that she'll announce her intentions by Monday.
Okay.
I'll bet you a dollar.
A lot of testing the water up on Mackinac this week.
What is the time to do it?
Well, this is a conference that historically has made candidates. That Rick Snyder really owned this when he was the Republican candidate for governor, and 8 years before that, 12 years before that, an obscure attorney laboring for Wayne County was brought out, and Jennifer Granholm was the subsequent Attorney General, and then Governor of Michigan, and this conference was really kind of her coming out party as well. So, this is someplace where politicians come to be seen.
Dreams made and broken on Mackinac Island.
Well, in our last minute, tell me, what's the big hits? What are you both looking for this week at the conference?
I think it's going to be interesting. Tomorrow late afternoon, there's a forum for some of the candidates running in the Detroit mayoral race. That'll be interesting to hear what they have to say, of course. Folks running for mayor, even though the the city is under emergency management. So we'll hear some answers to questions probably about what you will do with the city when, how do you actually govern if it's under state-appointed emergency management. It'll also be interesting to hear the conversation among the so-called quadrant. That's the Democratic and Republican leaders in both the State House and Senate. Republican Senator Randy Richardville, Democratic Senator Gretchen Whitmer, Republican Speaker of the House Jace Bolger, Democratic House Leader Tim Grimmel.
Yeah.
We can only assume that they're going to be talking about the budget that's being passed in Lansing.
Well, that's on its way to the governor. But, you know, you look at all of the things that are stalled right now, and these are things that are on businesses' wish list, that we're talking about road funding. We're talking about the Medicaid expansion. We're talking about these Common Core standards that we were just talking about. I think one of the big questions as legislators arrive later today, can these business people convince the legislature to move on those issues that are so important to them?
Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark, the co-hosts of It's Just Politics, right there in the thick of things on Mackinac. Thanks, guys, so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Well, here's a question to chew over. How deeply should citizens be involved in governing our counties, cities, townships, or villages? Well, put another way, how deeply do our local leaders want us to be involved? That's the question the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan put to more than 1,300 local government officials all over Michigan. Tom Ibacco from the Center joins us with the verdict. And welcome back, Tom.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Well, your survey seems to indicate local leaders want us to be involved, but not too deeply. What'd you hear from them?
Yeah, that's about right. So we asked local leaders all over the state, 72% response rate, so that, very representative, what their views are on the proper role for citizens in terms of local governance activities. And, I think interpreting the data really depends on whether you see the glass half empty or half full.
All right.
So overall, 81% of these local leaders say that they want citizens involved in some fashion, at least giving some basic levels of input and feedback.
You would think. I'm actually surprised it wasn't virtually 100%, that there were literally some who were like, no, I don't want them involved.
There are. And in fact, out of these 81%, most of them, 64% of Michigan's local leaders, basically say they want citizens to provide some input, but really not too deeply. We based this the survey around a particular model of citizen engagement that's been developed by a major international organization, and it provides a spectrum of engagement opportunities.
All right, such as?
On the low end, it's basically keep your citizens informed. Send them newsletters, put information on your website so that they know what's going on.
All right.
On the high end, it's really involves citizens deeply in decision making. And what we found is most local leaders are closer to that low end.
So they're kind of saying, we want you involved, we want you informed, but not don't be crawling on our backs. And
yeah, for the most part, that's pretty accurate. They want feedback. There's no question about that. 17% really say just keep citizens informed. Really don't provide too much input even. Hmm. That's really on the low end. But most local leaders are above that. They want at least some basic input from citizens and feedback.
Because one must wonder, if they don't want input and don't want citizens engaged, why would they not want citizens engaged? Isn't that the whole foundation of democracy?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question.
And go a little deeper for us as far as what they feel is the downside of an intensely involved citizenry.
Well, there are costs. Local leaders do identify costs associated with fostering citizen engagement. And that includes, certainly costs on the jurisdiction's budget. So it takes money to reach out to citizens and to pull them in and deal with the input that they're providing, depending on how local governments try to do that. Fostering engagement tends to increase demands on the jurisdiction's personnel. And, so as we've seen in some of our other reports through this the survey program, mm-hmm. local governments in Michigan are in a retrenchment mode. They have cut staff, they've cut services, they have fewer resources and funds to do this type of stuff with. So it's not free to try to
That's
engage
true.
Citizens.
Didn't think about that. So overall, what do you feel these results reflect in terms of trust from citizen to local elected leader and vice versa?
Well, as you know, from our most recent report that we put out a little over a month ago, trust is in short supply in Michigan. Certainly, citizen trust towards government is in short supply. We found more trust of local leaders towards their citizens. And so there's this, you know, if there's political trust in the state of Michigan, most of it is from local government leaders feeling like their citizens can be pretty responsible. You know, what we also found in that survey was the more that citizens are engaged in their local government, the more that leaders trust them. So there's kind of a positive feedback loop.
But there is a dichotomy. Engage, but don't engage too much.
That's right. Don't engage too much. And certainly, if you're going to engage, do it in a responsible way. Come informed. Come with an open mind. Be ready to make your arguments and listen to other people's arguments, because there's always two sides.
Interesting, interesting look at attitudes all across Michigan in terms of our local leaders towards us, the citizens. Tom Ivacco is with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Always fun to talk with you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Suffering loss and going through grief is a part of the human existence. There is not a one of us who will skate through life without having to cope with losing someone very close to us. But sometimes that loss is sudden. It's horrifying. How do you possibly climb out of that pit of grief once that happens? That's the question addressed in a new documentary called Transforming Loss. In this film, we meet six Michigan families who have managed to triumph, transform, even grow, despite indescribable heartbreak. And they have lessons for each of us. Joining me here in the studio is the filmmaker Judith Burdick, who's also a licensed psychotherapist in Oakland County, and one of the people who shared her story of loss and transformation, a story that began for her when her teenage son committed suicide. These days, she volunteers for the Heinz Prechter Bipolar Research Project at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Elizabeth Guz joins us as well, and it's a pleasure to welcome both of you. Judith, I want to start with you, because your story is really a part of this, your desire to make a film that focuses on how people transform a deep loss into a force for good. This has a very personal origin for you, doesn't it?
It sure does. It started about 22 years ago when my then-husband was killed suddenly in a scuba diving accident, leaving me with two small children to figure out how to survive and then how to go on.
And how did you do that, and how did you transform? Well, how did that change your life? How did it drive you?
Well, it was a drive, and it continues to be a drive. But at the time, it drove me to want to become a psychotherapist specializing in grief and loss. I always wanted to go back to school to become a therapist when my children became old enough. But this specialty, you know, is definitely an outgrowth of that experience. And then, you know, moving forward with that, the next step for me was creating this film, which is also just part of that evolution.
Well, the film is incredibly honest, and the people who were a part of this, including Liz, we're going to talk to Liz in a moment, but it was stunning to me how open people were about the depths of their grief. Who did you pick and why?
Well, it's very interesting. The process of choosing people was almost bigger than just me picking them. They had to decide, yes, I will participate in this. And I reached out in a multiple of ways, one of which through my practice, and then networking with other therapists in the area and people, and, you know, remembering stories and trying to connect with those people, like Gary Weinstein, who lost his entire family. I think everyone in the area remembers that story. So a lot of different ways of reaching out, but I presented the opportunity, and each one of these individuals said yes.
And you had everything from a young girl. You had Gary, who, as a more mature husband and dad, loses his wife and both sons, and Liz. Liz, your son Michael committed suicide at age 17. Why would you want to revisit such a tragic and painful period in your life when you said, yes, I'll be a part of this film?
Right. Well, my first instinct was, oh, my God, I can't do this. It's so personal. But, you know, I really wanted to make Michael's life have more meaning, and I wanted people to really understand what he went through and what we went through as a family dealing with his illness. He was a great kid, and he really fought everything so hard, and I wanted people to really understand what he went through and how about suicide not really being something as a weakness, but something that he was just trying to end his pain.
Tell us a little about Michael.
He was smart, funny. He really worked very hard. He was an honor student. And he always just had this tormented side of him. And he fought it as best he could. We have gotten him a lot of help. He did not respond to medication at all. And it was very frustrating for him and obviously for all of us and just heartbreaking. And he, you know, when I say he committed suicide, he did have a suicide note. He did not, he had it in his wallet, but he actually overdosed. And I don't believe that he really, like, picked when this was going to happen, but his behavior became more and more reckless, you know, knowing that it was eventually going to happen. And it was just heartbreaking for our whole family to watch him go through this. And I know he felt horrible that we were all suffering with him also.
And I could only imagine it would be very easy to fall into something inward where you wall off. Did you go through that before you began to grow out and reach up?
Oh, for sure. I mean, even before Michael died, I mean, we were going through such a horrible time, and I really didn't tell anybody. You know, people did not know what was going on. I'd come home and just, you know, cry but put on a completely different face, you know, to the public, because I really didn't want people to know what was going on. I wanted to protect Michael, and I always had hoped that he would be okay. But after this happened, and obviously it was very public, you know, I had to make a conscious choice that I had two kids, I have a husband, and I needed them to know that we can't change the past, we have to move forward. And I just kind of had to pick myself up and move forward and try to make some positive things out of this situation. And that's when I got involved with the Prector Fund and just, you know, talking to other people. People would contact me with their problems with their kids. And I just tried to be, you know, to do the best I can. But, you know, I have my times where I lay in Michael's bed and cry. You know, I do. And I let myself do that.
Judith Burdick, your film is Transforming Loss, and it says, here's the slogan, transformation is the opportunity to become extraordinary. How do the people you've profiled, Liz and the other five families, what do they do to take this tragedy, whether it's a infant who dies or a man who loses wife in both senses, how do they transform into something extraordinary?
By becoming proactive. And what I mean by that, and you, once you see the film, the viewer sees exactly how each individual person or a couple has become proactive in their own healing journey. And one of the ways that people, these individuals, as well as myself, have done that is by reaching out to try to help others who are going through such similar losses, to try to make it better, to try to make a contribution. Those are some of the really positive ways and proactive ways that people have done that, and all of these people have that in common. They take their loss and they do something with it, and that really gives us the opportunity to make that loss meaningful.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Judith Burdick of Bloomfield Hills. Her documentary is called Transforming Loss, looking at six Michigan families who really managed to triumph and transform and even grow despite suffering incredible heartbreak and loss of someone very, very near and dear to them. And one of the people profiled in the film is my other guest, Elizabeth Guz. I want to ask both of you about this. One of the stories, one of the people profiled in the film, mentioned him, is Gary Weinstein of Novi. And so many people who followed the news remember the appalling tragedy. It was May 2005 when an incredibly drunk driver smashed into a car carrying Gary's wife and two boys and killed all three. And in the film, he notes that so often people do not know what to say after a tragedy. And I'd like to get the thoughts of both of you. And I'll start with you, Liz, because you had to go through this when your son Michael committed suicide. What are the do's and don'ts of reaching out to someone after a loss like you suffered?
You know, I think it's just to do whatever you feel. And like what Gary said is true. Just being there, a hug, you know, even if someone says, I don't really know what to say, and but they're just there for you. You know, probably for me, the thing that was the best to say is, you know, oh, I know, like my old grandfather, you know, he just died. You know, it's different when you lose a young person. And so that would probably be the one thing that I would say maybe not to say. But typically just being there and just giving support and understanding and love is, that's all you can really do.
Also, I'd like to add to that, people, it seems counterindicated, but people really like it, and myself included, when somebody comes up to you and says, God, how are you doing? I really feel bad, and, you know, I knew that person. You know, a lot of people are afraid to bring it up out of fear that it's going to, you know, derail the person who's suffering. But really, it's comforting when somebody says, I remember, because, you know, it validates the fact that they existed. And when somebody is gone, it's very frightening to think that people will forget who they are. So when somebody is reminded by somebody else who, you know, is observing their loss, it's always good to bring them up. It's a good thing, not a bad thing.
And Liz,
absolutely. I love hearing stories about Michael, you know, that people had experiences with him that I didn't know about. I love to hear them, and I'm so happy when someone comes up and tells me them.
And to those who might be listening to us right now who are acutely suffering that grief, because it really, there's a point where it isn't part of your consciousness, it's not on your radar screen, and then just like that, you are among the ranks of the grieving. So I want to ask both of you, where do you begin to use that grief to grow outward? What's the first step to take, Judith?
Ideally, from a psychotherapeutic perspective, the best thing to do would be to seek help. So to contact a therapist specializing in grief or a therapist who you find to be comforting, a support group, any kind of way to connect with others or another person who can be a witness to your pain, your loss, your suffering, and validate what you're going through is a great first step.
What would you say as well, Liz, as having...
I mean, I agree. I mean, we we all went to therapy. In fact, Judith was my daughter's grief therapist, and that's how I met Judy. But yeah, we all did that. I think that's really important. Good friends, you know, my family, my husband, we you know, just really talked a lot about it, and just getting support from people. I agree. Talking about
Liz
it.
How do you regard death now that it has touched your life in such a powerful way?
You know, I don't fear death like I used to at all. And I do feel like there is, you know, something out there that's bigger than all of this that just makes it a lot more comforting for me.
Do you see that, Judy? Often?
Absolutely. I feel that way, too. And you'll see that, and it's a thread that weaves through all of the stories in this film. Most of these individuals have a strong faith and a sense that life goes on. There's a continuity to life and that, you know, we're here for a while. You know, some of us longer. Virginia Beckley states that very poignantly. However, you know, there is a sense that life goes on afterwards. Most of the people are either clear with that, or they're the young girl, you know, the 25-year-old girl, Ricky Friedman, is still working on trying to figure that one out. But several of the people in this film, including myself, have that strong sense that there's something bigger and there's a purpose to all of this.
The film is called Transforming Loss, a documentary, and you can order the DVD or you can learn more about the film and future showings by going to the website transforminglossdocumentary.com. All one word, transforminglossdocumentary.com. I've been speaking with the filmmaker, Judy Burdick. Thank you so much for joining us. And Liz Guss, thank you so much. It's been a really pleasure, and thank you for sharing your life story, and I think we've all learned good lessons from both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you might want to know, the film Transforming Loss is playing tomorrow, that's Thursday night, at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. As more and more cities and school districts across Michigan are found to be in a state of financial emergency and come under the control of a state-appointed manager, the question remains, how effective is this state oversight? That question's popping up again with news that an independent review team has found the city of Hamtramck is in a state of financial emergency. And this news comes 6 years after Hamtramck emerged from state oversight. The review team found Hamtramck is not able to make its monthly pension payments. The general fund deficit should hit $3.3 million by the end of June, and a structural operating deficit has existed in the city's general fund over the last three fiscal years. So what happened? Did state emergency management fail the first time round? And why would it work any better if Governor Snyder decides to appoint another EM? Joining me is Karen Majewski. She has been mayor of Hamtramck since 2005, and she's the immediate past president of the Michigan Municipal League. Mayor, thank you for talking with us. Were you at all surprised by what the review team found?
No, frankly, I don't think that anybody, either elected or appointed, in Hamtramck was surprised by it. We've been in conversations with the state for at least the last year and a half, and on a more informal basis, probably for the last 3 years, about our financial problems that we did see coming and that we've been trying to work through for the last several years. So this is not a surprise to us, and it shouldn't be a surprise to the state because they've been well-informed and working with us for quite a long time.
So let's drill right down to it. How do you think Hamtramck got here again 6 years after emerging from state management?
Well, I think that there's a confluence of factors, not all of them unique to Hamtramck. Some of them are. You know, you mentioned my experience with the Michigan Municipal League, and, you know, one thing that we can say across the state is that our cities are suffering. And part of the reason for that suffering is that our state administration, that's legislative and executive, has systematically kind of denied promised funding to cities. So funding is, you know, relief has been given to businesses, but no relief has been given to cities. And in fact, up until, well, yesterday we did get some news that, some good news about money going back into revenue sharing. But, you know, as we know, over the last 12 years, cities have lost $6 billion in state funding. So whatever you add that to other traditional ways that cities are funded, property taxes, what's happened to our property taxes over the last several years. I can tell you that Hamtramck's lost about 30% of our property value in the last 5 years. So between funding drying up from the state, funding being taken away by the state, between property values decreasing and the general malaise in business and employment that we're just now starting to crawl out of.
Mm-hmm.
All these factors together spell trouble for any city. For Hamtramck, we have some additional factors. American Axle closed down, one of our main sources of tax revenue. The GM Poletown plant, we lost about $2.7 million a year in GM Poletown plant revenues.
Hmm.
So it's not simply, you know, poor management or, you know, not learning the lessons of earlier, you know, financial distress. There are factors that have affected Hamtramck, some of the same factors that have affected cities all across the state, and then, you know, some very particular losses for Hamtramck. And that's not to say that we couldn't be doing things more efficiently, that we couldn't be doing things better in Hamtramck. But to simply say, well, you know, cities need to change their act and need to get with the times and need to be run more like a business, I think really attempts to absolve responsibility for some other factors that are beyond the control for the most part.
I do wonder, Mayor Majewski, do you accept at all the review team's finding that that basically despite worsening financial conditions, they found that city officials didn't adequately address that condition?
To some degree, I do. You know, some of the findings, for instance, it talked about the instability within the administration, especially with our city manager situation, in which we've had quite a few city managers in the last year. But part of that was the attempt to gain stability, so to put the right person in the job. And in fact, we did two city manager searches in the last year, and in neither case did we hire someone because we didn't feel that we'd found the right person for the job. So to simply say that, well, that's a sign of our inability to cope with the situation, I think it's in part a symptom of the situation and of our attempt to cope with it.
Mayor, have you spoken with Governor Snyder?
No, and in fact, I have not spoken to Governor Snyder personally. I'm not sure that Governor Snyder has ever set foot in the city of Hamtramck.
Hmm. What would you like to tell him if you were able to sit down and have a conversation with him?
Well, I'd like to tell him, first of all, I'd like to show him around our city and show him, you know, Governor Snyder talks a lot about some very good things, about the importance of place, about the importance of community, about the importance of vibrant living communities that engage their residents, that create a sense of identification, and that then can attract businesses because of diversity, because of walkability, because of a sense of strong place. Those are things that Hamtramck has, and I'm not sure that he realizes that. I'd like to walk him around the city and show him just how alive we are, just how well, how much we could be a model for the revitalization of our local communities. And then I'd like to talk to him about the way municipalities are funded. I'd like to talk to him about how hard I see my fellow elected and appointed officials working to make their cities viable, to bring good projects to their cities, to serve their residents. I'm not sure that gets recognized in the governor's office.
Do you, and I'm going to ask you this as the past president of the Michigan Municipal League, as well as the mayor of Hamtramck, is the emergency manager system a viable way to rescue and help a city that's financially distressed?
Well, that's a very good question. And you know, I've been in close, you know, worked closely with the system under both iterations, mm-hmm. under Act 72, the old emergency financial manager law, and now potentially with an emergency manager.
Public Act 436, yes.
Exactly. What I hope the changes in the new law will bring about are closer oversight of the manager himself or herself and a closer working relationship between the managers and the administration and the elected officials. The purpose of the manager should be to help the city, maybe do some things that the city can't do itself. And, of course, the new law gives some of those powers that the old law did not mm-hmm. and that elected officials do not have. Those may be very necessary powers. But what I saw under the last law that made things very difficult and made the relationship very contentious that I would like to see change, and I hope under the new law will change, is that the emergency manager is not there to remake a city or to meddle in anything beyond the his or her job concerning finances. The job of the emergency manager is to help the city make the changes it needs to make to be viable, to go forward, to find ways to work within its means and to grow, because none of our cities are going to survive by simply cutting our budgets down to meet the existing revenue as it is today. We need to find ways to grow that revenue, you know, whether that comes from, you know, partially through revenue sharing, but certainly other ways, shared services. I would like to see a system in which that function is the only function.
Yeah.
That the goal, finally, is to make a more vibrant and viable city. And I'm not sure that was the way things worked under the old law.
Karen Majewski is the mayor of Hamtramck. An independent financial review team recently found the city in a state of financial emergency. Governor Snyder is now deciding whether to accept that finding. Mayor, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's turn now to one Detroiter's view of Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr, who's been on the job since March 25th. Over these past couple of months, have Kevin Orr's loyalties been more to the city he's running or to the state who hired him? Detroiter Karen Dumas was the chief of communications for the city of Detroit, working with Mayor Dave Bing. These days, she heads up her own PR communications firm, Images and Ideas, and she is closely watching what's happening at City Hall. Her recent column in Bridge Magazine shows when it comes to emergency manager Orr, Karen Dumas has some growing doubts. Welcome back to the program, Karen.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you.
Well, your column states in Bridge that you feel Kevin Orr's early days are proving that he's more loyal to the state than to the city. Why do you say that?
Well, I just, you know, and certainly that's not necessarily, I don't want to say it's a bad thing, but it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, he was brought in by the governor. I mean, early on he was asked, to whom would he be loyal and was his boss? And he immediately responded, the governor. I think I would have at least said, well, the citizens of the city of Detroit, although I do report to the governor. I mean, that would have probably sent a good message. But I think that some of the things that he's doing are not necessarily on the early front in the best interest of the city of Detroit. I think he's injecting himself into things that are not necessarily related to stabilization of the finances. You know, his initial report, and again, this is early,
right.
But the initial report was just a regurgitation of information that we already knew. I mean, the city of Detroit has been saddlebagged with report after report after report. The challenge now is, what are we going to do about it?
Now, am I correct, though, that the EM law requires him to deliver that fiscal report card first and then come up with the plan of action?
Yes, so that is the expectation.
Yeah.
But I guess, I think people are pretty apathetic. We know, you know, the finances are bad. But, and maybe this will come forth in the second report, which I think is due shortly. I don't know the time frame on that. But, you know, I'm looking for operational restructuring. You know, what is he going to do differently in terms of how the city functions? What are we going to do to generate revenue? So, I don't know. We'll see.
Now, it's interesting. In your piece that you wrote in Bridge, you say the pledged partnership between the city and the state is, in your terms, anything but. What don't you like about what you're seeing when we're talking the overall partnership between the state and city? What would you rather see?
Well, what I'd like to see is an execution of some of the things that I think both the Bing administration, you know, said early on in terms of, you know, public safety. I mean, we know there are lighting issues. You know, we've got some things that are of immediate concern to residents. I think the partnership would be to make sure that the decisions that are made are in the best interest of the citizens. And maybe at the end of the day, they may be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you've got the involvement of Orr's firm, Jones Day, that's involved. I mean, I think that
his former firm, right? Because he has resigned from Jones Day.
Yeah, but you know, that's a paper resignation. You know, I mean, if you and I know each other, mm-hmm. are we going? You know, I mean, that's that's questionable.
Okay.
You know, I think that his involvement in the selection of a police chief, you know, kind of fall outside of what he should be immediately responsible for. I mean, even though this chief is from the city of Detroit, I think it was kind of a slap in the face because everyone wanted to at least give an internal candidate an opportunity, and some of the candidates were saying they weren't even seriously interviewed. So those are just a couple of the things. I also think that his decision not to attend the Mackinac public policy conferences, you know, kind of a I don't need to circulate or communicate or interact with the other decision makers in a public capacity.
Could one make a case, well, gee, he shouldn't be up schmoozing on Mackinac, he should be fixing things at City Hall?
Yeah, that could be, but, you know, the reality is that he goes home every weekend. So, you know, he's here 4 days a week for all practice. I mean, that's the reality. And, I mean, that information is being FOIA'd. So I'm sure that will come out. So I do think, though, for all the schmoozing that takes place at Mackinac, you know, it is an opportunity to get a better pulse on what is wanted, desired, or the plans that are in place for the city and the region.
I'm talking with Detroiter Karen Dumas, who is head of PR communications firm Images and Ideas, but with a lot of perspective on the city of Detroit because she was chief of communications for the city working for Mayor Bing. And Karen, I know you get quite a few comments when you put up on your Facebook page asking about Kevin Orr and loyalties, and one comment jumped out, and one man wrote, "It's too bad the leaders of Detroit let it get to this point, mm-hmm. as the citizens of Detroit were failed in so many ways. It will be like extracting teeth at the dentist, but in the end, we'll all be better and can begin anew." What did you think about that comment?
Well, and if you remember my earlier piece, mm-hmm. you know, I did say a lot of the fact that we do have an emergency manager falls in the laps of everyone, our elected leaders, you know, our citizens. Everybody takes some degree of responsibility for the city being in the condition that it's in and making it susceptible to an emergency manager. So, I mean, I understand that, and I do hope that at the end of the day, Detroit has a different, a better, a more positive and productive appearance than it does now. You know, I had a conversation with someone earlier today, and certainly there are pockets of Detroit that are great,
yeah.
but there are so many areas overlooked and that need drastic attention. So, you know, how do you balance those things? But, you know, I mean, he's here. I certainly hope that his presence is going to be for the benefit of the city of Detroit first, for the region second, and that at the end of the day, we all come out ahead. That's yet to be seen.
I have to ask your thoughts about the possibility that at least parts of the DIA collection could be sold to satisfy creditors. I know that news broke just about the time your column
right.
was in Bridge. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I'd heard that conversation. I did not expect to see it public so soon, but this is a bankruptcy attorney. So certainly if, in fact, you know, bankruptcy is an option, we have to acknowledge the fact that the city of Detroit owns the building, owns the property, and certainly some of the assets therein. However, you know, I do see this being tangled up in court for a long time because people are going to fight that tooth and nail. So let's hope not. I mean, I really hope that those changes can be made and a stabilization realized before it gets to that point.
Karen Dumas, her piece on Detroit's emergency manager, can be found in Bridge Magazine, and she joins us regularly with views and thoughts on what is going on in the city of Detroit. Always good to talk with you, Karen.
You as well. Thanks. Have a great day.